Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 9th, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, we have a fascinating show for you, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. This is my pledge to you. We've been going on over 4 years strong. Isn't that crazy? We're already on episode, what is this? 215. We've never charged for an episode. And the way that I'm able to do that, being kind of a one-woman band here, is that I sell ad space, of course, and I use the crowdfunding model. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/talknerdy. You can read all about it. And if you'd like to, you can pledge your support. Because of the support from individuals like you who can afford to help the show out, you know, to help me hire the editor that I need, to help me pay my assistant, and, you know, just cover some of the costs of doing a podcast week after week after week. Because of those of you who can help out, you make it so that people who maybe are less fortunate, people who aren't able to do so, can continue to listen for free. So I want to give a special shout out to a handful of you who are pledging at the top tiers. The very top tier is Rob Schreck. Gosh, thank you so much, Rob. You are just incredibly essential to the show at this point. It's just so wonderful that you've been able to support the show in the way that you have. Everybody really does thank you. I also want to thank Phil T-Bear. Same, Phil. You have been with us for such a long time. Thank you so much. And of course, I want to thank those in the next tier, the names that you've grown to know and love. The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payett, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, that's with a U. Honorable, Jafe, Gabriel, Felipe, Jaramillo, Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so very, very much. All right, guys, this week is a fascinating one. We get to have a chat with Margo Mifflin. She's a professor at Lehman College of the City University of New York and CUNY's Newmark Graduate School of Journalism. And we're going to talk, she's written several books, but we're going to talk about her most recent two, or the two that are relevant to the conversation, The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman, and Bodies of Subversion, A Secret History of Women and Tattoo. So without any further ado, here she is, Margo Mifflin. Well, Margo, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I am really excited because we connected a little bit ago. I don't even remember offhand. I might have to look at my calendar. Do you remember when we did that natural history thing?
I think it was April. Was it April 12th,
okay. Maybe? Yeah, so it was a few months ago now. We connected because we worked on a panel together at the Natural History Museum because they had a featured exhibit all about tattoos. And it was super cool to be able to, I moderated this panel, and you really were in many ways kind of the expert panelist. We had two female tattoo artists and then you, the historian, to talk about kind of the culture of tattooing and specifically the culture of female artists within the tattoo world. You've done a lot of work on, and I don't even know if I could point to anybody else who studies this, on kind of the history and culture of tattooing and of tattooing females and kind of the women's body kind of aspect of this. What got you into that?
Well, I was writing about the visual arts, and when I got interested in writing about tattooing, it was the mid-90s. I was a freelance writer writing about visual art, getting a little disillusioned with the elitism of the art world and the money of the art world, and I was interested in art forms that were more popular or populist. And so I had this idea to write a book about female subcultures, women who were, well, let me just backtrack. I was noticing that a lot of women were getting tattooed, and I had been writing about feminist art. So I saw this intersection between feminist art and tattooing. You know, tattooed women were performing a kind of feminist art form by tattooing their bodies. And I was interested in why they were doing that, what they were getting, and if it was different from what men were getting. And then that led to a curiosity about women tattooists themselves. So I started researching and interviewing people and ended up writing about both women tattooists and tattooed women.
You have worked for quite a while as a journalist. You're also a journalism professor, correct?
That's correct. I'm technically an English professor. I teach at Lehman College at City University of New York. At Lehman, I teach undergrads, but I teach at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and previously directed the arts reporting program there.
So the focus generally of your work over the years has been on the arts.
Exactly, the arts and women's history. And I didn't initially intend to spend 20 years writing about tattooing. I got involved, did the research, wrote the first edition of this book, Bodies of Subversion, A Secret History of Women in Tattoo, that was published in the late 90s. And then in 2001, saw that so much had changed and there were so many more women involved in tattooing that I updated it, added more women artists, added a much wider range of tattoos that I had seen during that period. And then again in 2013, updated it. So three editions technically of the book exist. And then during that time, actually after I wrote the first edition, I discovered the woman who is technically the first white tattooed woman in the United States, Olive Oatman. A woman came up to me at a lecture I was giving in Nebraska and said, "Do you know about this woman?" And I said, "No," and went home and did a little research and realized she had her own really fascinating story that I ended up adding to the second edition of the book. And then after that, wrote her biography because it was really hard to contain her story in the two or three pages I used on her in the book.
And so that is your book, The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman.
She
wasn't just the first, you know, Western or American, you know, white woman with tattoos. She had them on her face. Like, she was very tattooed.
Yeah, now, on one hand, the, you know, tattoo traditions around the world go back thousands and thousands of years. And in the U.S., she's, again, only the first in the sense of being a white woman because Native American women have been getting tattooed for centuries, and almost every tribe has some kind of tattoo tradition. Mm. But she was really unusual as someone who was traveling west on a wagon train with her family from Chicago, and they were attacked by, they are actually Mormons heading west to start a utopian society with 80 or 90 other people. And they didn't really know where they were going. They had an idea that, you know, they would find the Zion in California, which was not yet California. Mm-hmm. So they kind of set out in that direction. And when they got to Western Arizona, they were attacked and by one tribe, by the Avapai. Most of her family was killed. She and her sister were taken captive and they were held for a year, essentially as slaves with this tribe. But then they were traded to the Mojave Indians, who raised them as their own. They felt sorry for them. They saw them when they went on trading expeditions with the Avapai. So they traded for them, adopted them into the one family that was very interested in them, took them, raised them, tattooed them on their faces, and Olive Oatman survived. Her little sister died during a famine during that time, but Oatman survived. And one of the things I argue in the book is that she wanted to stay with the Mojave. She was ultimately ransomed back. She was taken when she was 13, and she was with the Mojave till she was 19. And then the U.S. Army they had been hunting for her for years, but they finally got some intel on where she was and they reclaimed her. But the argument I make in my book is that she didn't want to go and that the Mojave treated her as their own. And the tattoo was sort of central to that argument because they didn't tattoo their captives. They only tattooed their own. Mm-hmm. And they were very good to her. And she said as much when she was first ransomed back. Then she changed her story when a Methodist minister got a hold of her and began, well, he ghost wrote her biography, cleansed it of any Mormon references, spun it with a Methodist spin and took her on a tour where she told her story and basically said, you know, it was my faith in God that got me through this horrible ordeal with these savage Indians.
Wow. So really, like, it's such a prime example of what we often encounter even today when we're reading our scholastic history books, of just this rewriting of history in order to have some sort of political influence.
Exactly. And it was also about her reentry into polite society. It was pretty much unthinkable that a woman who was wearing a tribal chin tattoo, as well as, this was less often seen, but she had vertical tattoos on her upper arms. Mm-hmm. She didn't show them when she was lecturing, but a lot of people when she was on the lecture circuit wanted to see her chin tattoo and wanted to hear about her experience. But it was unthinkable that, you know, this woman could be accepted into polite society, saying that she loved her Mojave family and that she yearned for them, which she did say at one point. But funny enough, even that said, she did marry a wealthy cattle rancher and settled in Texas, in Sherman, Texas. And she did, interestingly, she being an orphan twice, she lost her biological parents and then she lost her Mojave parents. She worked at an orphanage when she was in Texas and ended up adopting a daughter from this orphanage. So her sort of rhythm of adopted families and adopted love was played out with her own daughter.
It's so interesting too that, obviously the work that you've done, and we'll dive into this, is not just about Western society, and that tattooing, as you mentioned, goes back thousands of years in kind of like Eastern societies, in more island cultures, and of course in indigenous peoples. It's interesting that the first, but I guess it makes perfect sense, that the first sort of Western white woman in the U.S. actually did have traditional Native American tattoos. That sort of the historical boundary there was blurred a little bit. Do you think that this actually set off the culture that we see now, or was this sort of a one-off that happened a long time before we started to see tattooing in the Western world as a kind of a cool thing to do?
I don't think it was considered cool at the time. Although, soon after that in Britain, society women were getting tattooed. So even though, you know, England has a history, its own history of tattooing going back thousands of years of more indigenous tattoo traditions, the sort of Western tradition got going in the late 19th century, and women were wearing tattooed bracelets and portraits of their husbands and even wedding rings. There was an op-ed in that period where a man proposed that women should get tattooed wedding rings because then they could be kept account of, you know, that married women wouldn't stray because everybody would know that they were married if they wore these wedding rings.
But no recommendation for men to do the same thing.
I don't think it went two ways. Yeah. And so that was, you know, the tradition was very high society in that period, partly because it was so expensive. It wasn't mechanized at that point. And only later in the century, in the 1880s, was the tattoo machine introduced. And so that's when people started doing broader body work, and then ultimately circus tattoos and full sleeves and full body suits for display. So there was, you know, quite a, I guess back to your question, Olive Oatman was really an outlier as a white woman with a tattoo. And I don't think, I'm sure that at that time, no one was imitating this or, you know, perceiving it as something desirable. It was really a mark on her.
And so there's so much in terms of timeline that I want to dive into, but I guess maybe we can like rewind back as far as we can. And I'm sure that this is not an easy question to answer, but do we have any idea about when and where the first tattooing really took place?
You know, it's hard to say. And since my focus is, well, actually, there is Ötzi, the a tattooed man who was found in the Swiss Alps is, I think, 5,000 some years old. So that's one of the oldest documented examples. Mm-hmm. The scholar who's really good on these international indigenous traditions is Lars Krutak, K-R-U-T-A-K, who has written really interesting books documenting the history and the tools and archaeology. So he's the go-to guy for that. My focus in my writing has been more 19th and 20th century and 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I guess previous to sort of more your purview and what you focused on, which also has a strong kind of feminist component to it, do you know if, you know, indigenous societies, early tattooing really drew a distinction between men and women the way that sort of modern Western tattooing kind of seemed to do, at least early on? Or historically, is it like, you know, men and women get tattooed? What do you want?
Yeah, I think there often has been a division, because often for women, it was a ritual, you know, like an adolescent ritual of transition. And, you know, sometimes specifically marking when the girl became marriageable or mm-hmm. just came of age. Whereas for men, more often it had to do with, you know, being a warrior or something other than a domestic identification. But it's really hard to generalize, because so many cultures vary so widely in what their reasons were.
Yeah, because in many ways, that although there are many Eastern traditions who follow those same kind of traditional gender roles, there is a big kind of Western tradition of sort of women as property or women as the domestic workhorses. And so it is interesting. It would be interesting, I think, to look at those parallels between different cultures. But of course, your focus has been on more modern tattooing. And, you know, when I think of sort of the beginnings of the modern tattoo culture in the Western world, I think of sailors. Like, that's the first thing that comes up in my mind. I'm remembering this very specific memory from when I was maybe a teenager, when my grandfather passed away, and maybe I was in late teens, I think. And at my grandpa's funeral, it was actually at kind of a celebration for my grandfather after his funeral at like the Kiwanis Club, or I don't even remember one of these. Oh no, it was the Knights of Columbus. You know, one of these, there's a big dance hall and all these people came in, and you know, my grandfather was in World War II and Korea. And so it was really cool to see this group of folks who came in, both men and women, who were like sleeved out on their arms, who were wearing like a Buddy Holly glasses. There was a few women who were wearing like, you know, circle skirts, very 50s. And it felt, you know, of the Betty Page era. And I remember thinking to myself, this is so funny because this is so in right now. Like, they look so rockabilly. This is what my peers are trying to look like, but they're the real deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people have that association, because that's what, you know, we mostly knew about through the media throughout much of the 20th century. It was really Ed Hardy, of, you know, the tattooist who was also the clothing designer, very influential tattooist, who really helped broaden our understanding of tattoo history, along with some other people of his generation. But he's just a really smart writer who was very deliberate about documenting the history, and had a really great magazine called Tattoo Time where he did that. And so, you know, that was probably started in the 60s and 70s, when people started to reclaim and recognize and explore the history beyond the 20th century Western traditions much more. And so I think a lot of us grow up with that idea of what you described.
Yeah, the very kind of Sailor Jerry-esque, what you might call traditional tattooing of anchors and pinup girls and, you know, hearts with daggers and this kind of, you know, ships, this kind of imagery, right? Like sailor tattoos.
Yeah. And it was Sailor Jerry, along with Ed Hardy and a few other people, who imported the Japanese influence into that tradition, which helped open it up to something with much more sophisticated design and much more wide-ranging cultural references that then made people think about other cultures that could import these practices or these traditions. I mean, there's always a little danger of cultural appropriation. And I think that happened a lot in the modern primitives movement of the 1980s, which a lot of contemporary tattoo practice is rooted in. But more so, I think it just sort of enlightened people to the broader traditions out there and informed and enriched the practices that they were doing. And so after, you know, Ed Hardy not only experimented, but also did the historical research and documentation, lots of other people followed. He was also one of the first people to have a studio as opposed to, you know, a street shop and to do custom designs instead of just, you know, flash, copied off a design, posted on the wall. He would, you know, work with people to design what they wanted. And not just the image, but also to place it on the body in a way that it complemented a particular body part.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I guess as long as I've been alive, that tradition has been strong. Yet there's still, I think, a segment of the population who maybe, or maybe it's just kind of about being naive when you first discover tattoo culture, if it's something you end up being a part of, where you have to learn that that's an option. You know, it seems like there is a lot of just walking in off the street and picking flash. And then almost everybody has a tattoo, an early tattoo that they're like super embarrassed about.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny, when we were at the panel and you asked what most surprised me since I had started doing this research, one thing is, I just can't believe people will just go out and get anything that they're going to wear on their body forever without, you know, doing research or understanding the historical precedents or even understanding if they're ripping off somebody else's culture, apart from just, does it look good? And what's the kind of, what are the aesthetic considerations, not only for this to look good on me, but also technical considerations, you know, about how it will look in 20 years or 50 years.
Yeah. Or even doing due diligence on the artist.
Right. So I'm amazed that I, to this day, meet people who I'll say, oh, you know, they'll show me their tattoo and I'll say, who did that? And the person will say, this happened with a student recently. I can't really remember her name. I just walked in and I'm thinking, you now have a relationship. Like, this person gave you something that will last forever and you don't know who the person is.
You know? Yeah, I think that there may be an assumption in individuals who never really thought about tattooing as a fine art form or never taught about tattooing as being, you know, having a historical contextualization, that sort of all tattoo artists come from the same tradition or that they all have the same skill or talent or sensibilities, and that you can just go and be like, yeah, I want like a lion. And then they'll be like, okay, I'll draw you a lion. And then that's your tattoo.
But exactly. I mean, it's
changed the gamut.
Yeah. And it has changed, you know, for better or worse. Reality shows helped a little in the sense that people could see the process and they could see that, you know, there are respected artists out there who have reputations, you know, good or bad, but who vary. And the reality shows, I think, did really help people understand you don't have to just go to the guy on the corner. You can actually seek out an artist. And they used to do, I forget the name, Ink Master, I think, used to do this thing at the end that I always loved, which was, the tattoo was done and then they'd have a crit, like an art school crit, where the artist or the judge would say, oh, yes, that's, you know, look what happened here. The shading is really interesting, but it's unusual that the light source is coming from the left and the shadow is also on the left and the colors are very rich and the line work is very delicate. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion of technical and aesthetic aspects of tattooing there that I think helped educate people a little bit in thinking about what they wanted.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because I mean, it's like you said, it's such a permanent process and you really are making a strong decision and a strong statement when you choose to adorn your body in such a way, especially if your, I think that there are different sensibilities about getting tattooed. I do think there are people out there who are like, I want a thing and I want that thing put on my body. And now I will remember that thing. And then there are other people that are like, my body is a canvas and I want to accentuate the curvature of my shoulder blades with some really beautiful design. You know, I think that's kind of a slightly different approach to being tattooed.
Yeah, some people are not interested in the sort of fine arts, high-end aspect of tattooing and like the lowbrow, just, you know, walk in, point to the flash you like and get it. And it's not so much about the image as what was happening in your life at the time you decided to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm personally more interested in the design aspects of it that have become so much more sophisticated in the past 20 years and take into consideration things like the body shape or the, you know, particular references from art history could be abstract expressionism, could be tribal motifs or indigenous motifs, could be watercolor designs. And I think it's really amazing to me how that has exploded in the time since the first edition of my book was published, that that the range is so wide and the technique is so remarkable. I don't think people understand how much goes into this. I'm also always amazed that art museums are so resistant to recognize, or the art world in general mm-hmm. is so resistant to recognizing tattoos. Part of it is about the sense that they can't be sold like artworks. So there's a sort of commodity aspect of it that's missing. But even aesthetically, there's still a snobbery in the art world that resists tattoos and fails to see that there are these blends of design sensibility, fine arts, graphics, sculpture, because it's happening on a 3D body. And it's also technically really difficult because the canvas is soft and pliable. It's not like a hard surface, not to mention a technical aspect where you're you have to master these machines, which can be finicky and, you know, control the needles and control the depth, or you have a bad tattoo that's going to bleed out or hurt the person or not last or whatever.
And of course, the canvas itself, like you really can't control, because there are people who just, they have good skin and there are people who have not so good skin for tattooing. Like, you know, my boyfriend, his skin is everybody. Every time he gets tattooed, his tattoo artists are just like marveling at how perfect a canvas he is, because he has this like very pale skin that takes ink really easily, doesn't flare up. He doesn't really get red much. And it's just, and he doesn't like scab or get what they call holidays in his tattoos. Whereas I like just whelp up terribly and I weep all sorts of interstitial fluid. And like, you know, I have a horrible kind of immune reaction every time I get tattooed. And so I don't heal as beautifully as I think other people do. So I know that the artist must be fighting all of these things, you know, while they're tattooing me, as opposed to somebody who's maybe a little, you know, has a better canvas.
Yeah, it's funny when you said it's, when you talked about the canvas, the behavior of the canvas, I thought you were going to mention the behavior of the fact that the canvas is a human being and can talk.
Oh, I'm
back.
Like all at the biological level. No, yeah, that's true. Yeah. The canvas is literally like twitching and right, needing and moving, cigarette breaks
and yeah, needing a break or telling you it hurts or saying, can I come back tomorrow or whatever, you know.
That's true. That's you forget about that too. And it depends too on the art, right? Some things don't take that long. Some things can take multiple sessions, 8 to 10 hours a session, going back over the same spot, reopening the wounds. It's, you know, it can be a pretty invasive process depending on the extent of the artwork, I think.
Yeah. And it's an intimate process. I mean, then there's this whole psychological aspect of it, which I think is why so many tattooists do have an intimacy with their clients, that, you know, you're doing this private thing for extended periods and you're talking. I've talked to a number of tattooists who've said that the clients open up to them and sometimes confide in them and sometimes have very emotional, well, not outbursts, but express themselves and their emotions in very intimate ways while they're getting tattooed. And there's a big element of psychology to it. Some tattooists like that. Others don't want anything to do with it, you know, just want to do the design.
I mean, I can see it's
sort of wearying or taxing.
Oh, yeah. Like the same. I mean, not the same, but I can see parallels with, like, you know, the bartender who's there night after night with the same people coming in and kind of like this sort of cheap therapy that they're experiencing. Or even with like a hairdresser or makeup artist, somebody who's there when somebody is maybe, you know, not feeling 100%, and then they really make them feel really beautiful on the outside. And that can be really transformational. Of course, for some tattoos, and this is something that we talked about a bit on the panel that I would love to dive into a little bit more deeply here. And this is, I think, more specifically a woman's issue, but it can be relatable to all genders and all orientations and identities, that tattooing for some people is really a mechanism for coping with trauma.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be pretty common, and and it can go both ways. It can be helpful. I've talked to people who've used tattooing to write over the trauma of sexual abuse and reclaim their bodies after sexual abuse. One artist did tell me she had a client who did this so much that she felt that the client was substituting tattooing for some, you know, more enduring kind of or psychological kind of help that she may have needed, and that the tattoos were serving as a band-aid for somebody who maybe should be talking to a therapist, not a tattoo artist.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode. And I have to admit, I'm so excited about my newest sponsor, Bombas Socks. They're literally the best. And it might sound crazy that I'm so excited about socks, but you forget how important they are to your everyday life. I don't wear open-toed shoes that often. I usually wear sneakers, so socks are a massive part of my daily routine. And Bombas are by far the most comfortable I've ever worn. I have a section of my sock drawer dedicated to them. And honestly, I don't wear my other socks anymore. That's because A, they have this great arch support system. You know, that part of your foot that like legit hurts at the end of the day from walking around. Bombas socks actually really help with that because they are reinforced with this great honeycomb that gives you a lot of support. There's also a cushioned footbed. And of course, my favorite part is they have stay up technology. I wear no-shows a lot, or like ankle socks, and they don't slip down in my shoes like almost every other brand does. But I gotta say, I think my favorite part about Bombas is that they are an incredibly pro-social company. You know, socks are the number one most requested item in homeless shelters. Of course, they keep people safe. They keep people comfortable. They keep people in many ways healthy. But you can't donate your used socks. So Bombas actually donates one brand new pair of socks for every single pair that they sell. And to date, that means over 7 million pairs. That is a massive deal. I don't know. I just love them. They're the best. And please, you know, I'm a woman telling you about Bombas socks, but they're not just for women. They're for men. They're for women. They're for genderqueer individuals, you know, non-conforming, non-binary. Everybody can wear Bombas because they come in every style, in every color to match your needs and to match your style, all the way from crew socks down to no-shows, everything in between. And of course, because I love Bombas and Bombas loves you, you can go to bombas.com, that's bombas.com/nerdy, and you'll get 20% off of your first order. Ooh, so exciting. Guys, don't wait. You will thank me. I know it. That's bombas.com/nerdy and use the code nerdy. I also want to thank Lightstream for their support of the show. Guys, if you are looking for an easy way to save some money, why not just lower the interest rate on your credit card debt that you're already paying? You can get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream today, and they reward consumers who have good credit with a great interest rate and no fees. I know that's you. I know you're responsible, but we all run into issues in our lives, and we really are a nation of credit. So many of us are carrying around this albatross around our neck. And one of the best ways to relieve that burden is to consolidate that debt. You can get a credit card consolidation loan from 5.89% APR with auto pay from Lightstream. Loans from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can choose your funding date as early as today. And what I love about Lightstream is that they fund almost everything. We're not just talking debt consolidation. We're talking auto loans. We're talking home improvement. We're talking goodness, aircraft loans. You in the market for a new plane? They even have those. Motorcycle, RV, trailer, boat. Did you know you could get a boat loan? How about a horse loan? All of these things are available from Lightstream. And as a listener of Talk Nerdy, you get an additional interest rate discount on top of Lightstream's already low rates. But the only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/nerdy. That's lightstream.com/nerdy. That's subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com for more information. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Yeah, I mean, because it's partially about, like you said, that intimate interaction and opening up about maybe things that are on people's minds, or maybe it's the impetus for getting the tattoo to begin with. And sometimes it's much more obvious, like, for example, this movement now of post mastectomy tattoos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really an interesting thing. And it seems to be very thriving. Going back to that question of what surprised me since I wrote the first edition of the book, the varied and growing specific applications for women is interesting. Mm-hmm. And the mastectomy tattoos in particular, because so many women who, have surgery maybe don't want to get, they have the mastectomy and then maybe they don't want to have reconstructive surgery because it's more surgery, more pain. Or because, as one woman told me, now I'm a woman without breasts. I don't need to pretend that I'm a woman with breasts. I had surgery. My breasts are gone. I'm willing to live with that and acknowledge that and maybe even let that be a sort of consciousness raising for what a lot of women are going through. Mm-hmm. But some women choose instead of reconstructive surgery or to cover scars from surgery to get the mastectomy tattoos. And that also, that range of imagery has expanded a lot. It seemed to be 10 or 20 years ago, it seemed to be mostly about very gentle floral imagery. Now I've seen some designs that are more unusual or abstract. They're not so, intent on having a kind of a soft, gentle look. They can have more of a design look. But that's a moving thing. It seems there's an artist, I forget his name, who's doing a lot of this. But I look at his Instagram and see that he's not just posting the designs he did. He's always posting about the emotional experience of doing this with women. And there was a Pink Day organized years ago. I think it's still going on annually, where a group of women get together at Saved Tattoo in New York, and they tattoo women who want this kind of tattoo design after mastectomies. And it's a very emotional, moving process and a healing process.
Absolutely. And, it's really interesting thing. One thing that struck me when you were just talking about that is that this Instagram artist who writes quite often about it and shares the work is male. And I remember at the end of the panel discussion that we were having, I kind of asked about whether or not individuals would choose, or why somebody might choose to have a female artist over male artist, or male artist over female artist. And I think, the general consensus is that people just choose artists that they think are good, the same way you would choose a physician that you think is good, regardless of their ethnicity or their gender or what have you. But at the same time, I made I opened up to the fact that, like, I don't want a male gynecologist. Like, to me, something like that is very personal and very invasive. And I just feel more comfortable having a female artist a female gynecologist, because, she has all the same parts. And I think that she might have a more sensitive touch or whatever the case may be. And that's not to discount.
More comfortable with the intimacy of the whole thing. With
absolutely. And that's not to say that there aren't, male gynecologists out there who are just as empathic and just as sensitive and have just as much capability in that realm. But for me, it's a gamble I don't want to take. And I completely understand both sides of that equation. But, we've been talking so much about women getting tattooed, but of course there's this there's this massive movement of more and more women coming to the forefront of being tattooers. Do you think that there is a, I don't know, that some segment of the population, that there is some sort of statistically significant group of women who would prefer to have women artists, especially when it comes to something like mastectomy scars? Or it, to me, it just seems so obvious. So it's interesting to me that a man on Instagram has like a lot of fame around this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there are two guys, I forget both their names, but who have established, you know, really strong reputations for doing this and are very gentle and understanding. Mm-hmm. But I do think, yes, that there are a number of women who prefer to have a woman tattooist. I don't know the numbers. I only know that in, I guess it was 2013, there was a shift nationally where more women were tattooed than men, but there's no kind of accounting for how many are tattooed by men versus women. Mm-hmm. But I think it's partly just women sort of taking their place in this industry as tattooists, and also claiming an area that's always been of interest to women: fashion and self-presentation, in the same way that women are interested in, you know, clothes and hair and jewelry and makeup. It sort of extends to body art. But some of it was really about women in the 70s, 60s and 70s, breaking in and integrating this industry. There have been female tattooists going back to, in the U.S. anyway, to the early 20th century. The recognized first tattooist name, the female tattooist name, is Maud Wagner. But I just discovered this amazing woman, Lorena Platt, and she was from Pittsburgh originally, and she was running her own shop, unlike Maud Wagner, who worked with her husband. This woman was running her own shop, and, you know, in the teens, the late teens, and in 1919, 5 years into her career, she had enough work that she was going to hire two tattooists, and she specifically wanted women. This was a shop in Norfolk, Virginia. And she ran an ad specifying that she wanted only moral girls who depend entirely on tattooing for a living and want to make it their profession, didn't want to hear from tattoo men's, as she put it, wives. She wanted independent
ladies.
So that was pretty early, you know, in the teens. And then there was a fabulous tattooist, fabulous in the sense of she was a great character, in the 20s, who was tattooing on the Bowery, a lesbian artist who tattooed a lot of lesbians in San Francisco in the 30s. So there was this progression of women, but they were mostly on their own throughout the first half of the 20th century. Then in the 60s and 70s, there got to be a greater volume of women tattooists who connected with each other and knew each other and shared information. And they were still kind of discriminated against and marginalized in some ways, but they just sort of established the momentum that has carried us to this point where it's not unusual to have a woman tattooist. Although I will add that I was shocked when one of my students this year who was tattooed, we were chatting about tattoos, told me that she wouldn't trust a woman to tattoo her.
Did she say why?
I said, you know, what is it? Like, I was, she wasn't very clear about it, but I did have to wonder, like, what's that about? Like, a woman can't hold a tattoo machine like a man?
Or, yeah, it's so,
you know, a woman
strange.
Doesn't have the history or what? And, yeah, I never quite got that.
And that's the thing that I wasn't surprised, because kind of nothing surprises me anymore when it comes to, like, you know, gender parity in the United States. But when when we were doing the panel and we were interviewing, who was on the panel? It was Rox.
Oh, Rox of Two Spirit Tattoo in LA, and Carrie Barba.
Oh, yeah, and Carrie Barba.
Established LA tattooist.
Yeah, two very, very sought after, like, famous tattooists who were incredibly talented with, you know, styles that couldn't be different. But both of them, you know, one of them kind of came up through the traditional West Coast culture, and the other one kind of came up through, like, bouncing around in Europe and has a lot more indigenous influence. Both of them sort of had independent stories about not being, when they were coming up, like, there not being that many women, really about mm-hmm. like not being able to find female mentors, having to sort of, you know, work within this very male dominated field and find their own path. And, you know, neither of them is, you know, an ancient person. Like they're,
right, yeah.
they're not in their 20s, but they're definitely yeah. like, they're still young. And the fact that so much has changed only in the past few decades, I think is really telling, isn't it?
Yeah. I think Rox is in her 40s and Carrie's in her 50s. And Carrie is sort of, she's close to the first generation of women who really broke in and went to the first conventions, you know, tattoo conventions that were established in the 70s. So, you know, I think that it must have been a very lonely business for the women starting out and also just taking a lot of guff from mm-hmm. men who didn't believe they could do it or didn't believe they should do it or put, you know, in the case of one artist, Vivien Lozanga, who was another pioneer in Seattle, she was sort of propped up in a window in one shop where she apprenticed for display. There was one artist who told me, she started early, Sheila May in the late 60s, that people would come to the shop window and point in and say, look at that, there's a chick in there tattooing.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, they couldn't believe it. So happily, that's not so remarkable, but I think there continue to be stories of bias. It's just not as bad as it was back in the day.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like you said, kind of the first time that we started to see a shift where there are more women getting tattooed potentially than men. I don't think we're seeing that tipping point within the tattoo shops by any stretch yet. I still think it's, you know, there are plenty of women who are doing tattooing now, of course, but I mean, at least in my experience, and this is anecdotal, it would be interesting if there were some actual hard numbers on this, but you know, in my experience, when I walk into a tattoo shop, it's generally still mostly men. There are generally some women in the shop, but also it's not uncommon when you walk in that the men are the tattooists and the women are the piercists working in the shop,
right.
Especially in street shops.
Yeah, or you hear stories about women who are tattooists and happen to be standing at the counter, and people assume they're the receptionists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's a bummer. Like that's just not, you know. But more and more, you know. One of the tattooists that I work with a lot in Los Angeles, her name is Kim Tsai. She's incredibly talented. She owns her own studio. You know, we mm-hmm. talked about Carrie. We talked about Rox. Like that, you are seeing a lot of these women who have private studios who only do things on, you know, not on commission, but whatever the word may be, that they only do, custom tattooing. You know, there's a waiting list. You have to apply to see them because they're so overwhelmed. So we are seeing a big change where these women have like lucrative careers running their own tattoo shops. I was really interested too. And I know that your books don't get into this too much because it's more about the art and the aesthetics and the history, but I was interested in the conversation we had in the panel about how important it is to be a good business person as well. Like you can't just be a tattooist. You have to also know how to make money and know how to manage your books. And it's a lot more than just being an artist.
Yeah, that's really important. And you know, some people do it better than others. it's, you know, varies from person to person. I'm thinking of Kat Von D when mm-hmm. you mentioned Kim Tsai, because I guess Kim was on her show, her reality show.
Oh, yeah, she was
show.
For, I think, like one season and then left because it was a bit trying for her, I think.
I forget what the reasons were, but it wasn't her bag, I guess.
Yeah.
But Kat Von D is interesting as somebody who became very well known internationally, who, you know, she sort of leapfrogged over a lot of other people in terms of making her name as an international figure very quickly
mm-hmm.
and, you know, doing decent tattoos. And from my understanding, being a good businesswoman,
mm-hmm.
You know, you never know from reality shows because you're always seeing the day-to-day dramas.
Yeah. But at the very least, media savvy, which is a part of being a good businesswoman, at least in LA.
Right, yeah. And for some people, conventions are an important part of sort of your media profile. Some people don't like to do conventions. They don't like to, you know, tattoo in public. A lot of people love it and get the, you know, get a thrill from just the energy of the whole thing and seeing everybody's tattoos. And there's a big social component, connecting with other artists and stuff. But I think some people just don't want to be involved in that.
Yeah. And I mean, that must be a tough decision to make, because ultimately it could be limiting, but also, you know, you do what you love as an artist because you love to do it. And so taking on something that you don't want to take on just for the exposure may not be worth it. And I think we see that a lot with this new, you know, I say new, but within the past several years, culture of social media, because how big is that for artists who, you know, and it's really a double-edged sword, because it's in many ways free marketing and free advertising, a way to really showcase your, what's the word I'm looking for, your portfolio. But also it just allows for so much more derivative, so much more like opportunity for somebody to kind of steal your work, to rip off your work, and to do tattoos in your style for maybe, you know, less money or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, copyright infringement. It really is a double-edged sword, because on one hand, there's so much sharing, and that is when I was talking about people getting more educated about tattoo and tattoo styles. That's one reason they have become more so. But yes, there is stealing and copying and just a kind of laziness. It's also had a really interesting impact on millennials, I think, because they have a, from my perspective, a much different approach to tattooing than older generations, partly because of social media and globalization. They live in a time where so much is shared. I mean, not just the tattoo imagery, but fashion trends just cycle around so fast that it's really hard to be individual. And I think for them, the interest in tattooing is not so much about being nonconformist as it was for previous generations, as it is for finding a way to mark your individuality in a global culture where it's hard to get your own private little identifier on your body through fashion.
You're so right. And it's so funny that you mentioned that. I think I brought this up on the panel, but for, you know, obviously everybody listening to the podcast, she wasn't there. I remember that I had a boyfriend in high school. Nope, in college. So, and I'd say I'm on the tail end. I don't like to consider myself a millennial, but I think technically I might be one, because I'm, right. I was born in 1983. And I think for a lot of people, they put the cutoff somewhere between 1980 and 1985. And so, I had a boyfriend who was a few years older than me, so he's maybe right on the cutoff, and legitimately looked like Sid Vicious, is still a visual artist. He's a potter, you know, was in art school and wore a padlock around his neck and had like the scruffy hair and was just like very punk rock. And he had bare, clean skin, not a single tattoo. And I always thought it was really weird. And when people would ask him, like, why don't you have any tattoos? He'd be like, all my friends have tattoos. It's like so passe.
Yeah, oh, that's so interesting, because that's the other thing that when we were talking on the panel, and you said what has surprised you over the years. When I was writing about this in the late 90s and then went on the college lecture circuit for a few years talking about the book, I thought, okay, I'm, you know, addressing these college students who are really into this now, but I wonder if in 20 years they're going to think, oh God, this is my parents' thing and I want nothing to do with this. Then it turned out, like at the time, I had a 3-year-old, and the next thing I know, she's a 23-year-old, but she's pretty interested in tattoos and has a tattoo and doesn't, you know, most of her friends don't seem to have that attitude of, oh God, it's my parents' thing.
So yeah.
It did sort of hang on. It really seemed to attach.
It did. And I think we're one of the first generations. I mean, of course, there are the sort of anomalous 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, again, like sailor types who were covered just head to toe with like neck tattoos and tattoos on their hands. But for the most part, I think that now we're seeing culturally, you know, you're out and about at the grocery store, you're at the zoo, you're at the museum, or maybe you're watching a television show that's like a reality show about home design, or, you know, something that's not about tattoo culture or about punk rock culture or nonconformist culture, where there's like a beautiful, loving family with a mom and a dad and maybe two young children, and mom and dad are literally sleeved out head to toe. And kids are just growing up with parents who are completely covered in bright, colorful tattoos. And that just wasn't the case, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. And so that'll be interesting to see. I mean, I guess it's already happening that their perceptions of tattoos are much different from, you know, kids 30 years ago.
And but also, they're
not perceiving it as, again, like nonconformist or extreme. It's just another kind of self presentation.
Well, especially if your parents just look like that, of course, like then maybe your way to be nonconformist is to not do it or to do it a different way. I think we're also seeing elderly people getting tattooed for the first times in their lives. And I think that's such a cool phenomenon.
Yeah, there is a lot of that. There is, however, I have to say, still prejudice against tattooed people. One of my students told me that she was waitressing while she was getting her degree, and she got a tattoo on her wrist. And people in this restaurant, it was in like suburban New York, really recoiled. And a woman who was a regular customer didn't want to have her as her waitress anymore. I was sort of surprised
that
in a cosmopolitan city or suburban, a suburb of a cosmopolitan city, that people would have this attitude, but I guess it's still out there.
Yeah. And the truth is, I do think that there's still a lot of gender bias around it. Like I've worked, in television, and I work as a science communicator on a lot of different TV shows. And I can't tell you how many times, for example, I've been asked to remove my lip ring or to cover the tattoos that are on my arms when male correspondents on the exact same show have visible tattoos and they're not asked to cover them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, I do think that there's kind of a gender bias and sort of a sexism that, like, men who have tattoos are just like rugged and they live harder, and women who have tattoos are maybe a little bit less educated, or they're, whatever that the case may be. I definitely see that I'm treated differently as a woman having tattoos and piercings.
That's crazy. I think there's also a sexual aspect to that, too, that there's still the notion still endures that tattooed women are sexually promiscuous. Mm-hmm,
exactly.
And, I've talked to women who, they're in bars and men come up to them and feel that it's okay to touch their tattoos and make comments about their tattoos and make comments about their bodies because they're tattooed in a way they might not to women who weren't tattooed.
Yeah. As if they're somehow asking for it, like that's an invitation.
Right. Yeah. Like you've made yourself public. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to come up to you and, take advantage of you in whatever way I want to.
Yeah.
Socially.
It's really, I think I've experienced that as well. And for me, I think the one thing that sort of has always been easier, an easier buffer for me, is that although I do have many tattoos, many of them have a science focus, a more kind of quote unquote educational focus. And that seems to buffer their effect a little bit with people who are maybe more judgmental about it. Cause it's like, oh, look, it's an Archaeopteryx. It's a transitional dinosaur fossil. Let's learn something from this, as opposed to if it were, something that was maybe more personal or more emotional or didn't have that scientific sort of quote unquote intellectual label. But I don't think that should matter.
Yeah, exactly. I meant to ask you, have you seen Carl Zimmer, the science writer's book, Science Tattoos?
Yes, I've seen Science Inc. And this is so great because
Science Inc., yeah.
Because Carl Zimmer was literally just on the podcast, and we didn't talk about Science Inc. at all. We talked about his new book about Heredity, but I love that book. I actually know Carl, and I think I have a signed copy of that book, but I didn't know him when he first made it. Otherwise, I probably would have weaseled my way into the book.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a great book to segue this podcast with
absolutely. And it does show that there are these like subcultures, right, that really embrace tattooing as a form of education or communication or sharing, or like we said, as a form of dealing with trauma, as a form of telling a story. Like tattooing has always really served that purpose, hasn't it? This kind of storytelling, cultural sort of collectivist purpose.
Yeah, and unifying people, specifically professionally, like with the science tattoos, there's books on food tattoos and all different kinds of professions. Food is especially interesting. A friend of mine who's a baker was telling me that a lot of people she works with are tattooed, and you see it on food shows.
Oh, yeah.
And she had a great theory, which is that for people who work in the food industry, you're a creative, but you're creating something that disappears really fast. So tattoos are appealing because they don't. And also because if you put them on your forearms, you can be, you're rolling up your sleeves while you're cooking, and you can be enjoying the tattoo while you're working.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah, it really makes sense for that profession.
Absolutely. And you're so right. I mean, I think anybody listening right now is nodding in agreement. Like, yeah, there is this like weird shift where all of a sudden all the people on all the cooking show, well, maybe it was that they happened at the same time. Maybe they always had the tattoos, but now cooking shows are really popular. Or maybe, cooking shows became popular there. And then you saw all these really cool tattooed people kind of flocking to it. But it is, I do think it is becoming more and more accepted. There are still pockets of individuals around the country who, yeah, kind of turn their nose up and still see it as a sort of nonconformist, like society decision, which is funny because, as you said, it kind of has, at least in Western society, very like high society roots, at least for women, which is so funny and ironic. But I also think it's really cool how you have managed in both of your books, both in The Blue Tattoo, The Life of Olive Oatman, and also in Bodies of Subversion, A Secret History of Women in Tattoo, have managed to use this really beautiful art form and this form of aesthetics to dig a little bit deeper into some of the, you know, contextual history of women and women's issues and how they sort of blend together with this beautiful art form. I have to ask you what you have coming up next, because I know that you're a journalist and you're a professor and you probably don't sleep very much. You must be on a new project, aren't you?
I am. Actually, I'm very happy. And I, for at least a week anyway, I've slept a lot because now I'm on sabbatical and I'm writing a book that is a cultural history of the Miss America pageant. There's a bit of a segue there in terms of, you know, women's bodies. These other two books were about, you know, basically women's bodies and how they embellish them and control them and so forth. So I am really interested in the Miss America pageant as, you know, an expression of cultural identity and the question of what exactly does it express about our cultural identity and about women and women's history. The fact that it was started the year after women won the vote, it launched in 1921.
Really?
It's hard to disassociate it from that fact, especially because the sashes that women wore for suffragette marches were appropriated by the Miss Americas for the Miss America contest. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a, you know, inversion there for a completely different purpose. And now we have a lot of interesting stuff happening with the swimsuit, having been just a few weeks ago, the announcement was made that the Miss America contest will no longer have swimsuits and evening gowns. So now the question will be, what exactly is it now? It's no longer a beauty contest. What is it?
I know, because it has always had that kind of, there's always been kind of a disquiet, at least in my mind, or at least in my emotions around Miss America, because on the one hand, and I think the most overt and obvious hand, it's always felt very kind of objectifying and sexist. And it's had that kind of really, you know, bad taste in my mouth sheen to it. But on the other hand, I've always seen it as at least sort of, I don't know, in the background, this empowering event where women from different cultures and different countries are on a world stage and they're able to really speak their mind freely, but within all these like really uncomfortable parameters. So it seems like it's just been this ambivalent kind of push and pull throughout history. And maybe it's finally breaking through some of those chains.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a tangle of paradoxes, as you say, because it has provided opportunities to a lot of women, specifically low-income women who needed scholarship money. Mm-hmm. And that's a cool thing. And that's an underreported thing. The question is just, should women have to do what they've had to do up until the swimsuit was removed in order to get these scholarships? And you think about all the time they have to spend a year building up to competing in the Miss America pageant, and what might they achieve if they were doing something other than that to get these scholarships? I want to find out if there's, you know, any comparison to be made between, you know, the women who became, you know, news anchors or doctors or whatever without Miss America. Did they get there faster, or did Miss America really put them on the fast track to that?
And also, did they make more, you know, because it's about the scholarship and it's about the prize, but at least in the pageant kind of junket, maybe somewhat separate from Miss America, but I'm assuming inspired by Miss America, you see that these women who are competing for titles and for cash are spending so much more money on the dresses and the makeup and the fake teeth and all of the horrible things to get there. And it's become a culture that's like, you know, little children are dragged into it. And, oh, there's so much that came out from this, right?
Yeah. I mean, they spend a lot to compete, and that's sort of hard to resolve. And you think about who the bigger name Miss Americas like Gretchen Carlson, who's the director of the Miss America pageant now, you know, four or five women like her have name recognition.
Yeah.
A lot of others don't. I mean, they may have perfectly satisfying careers or lives or whatever, but I'm trying to sort of tease out exactly what did it do for women, and also what damage did it do? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, at least in terms of race for the first half a century, women of color were excluded. And the only ever Jewish Miss America, Bess Meyerson, was asked by the director in the 40s to change her name so that she wouldn't be recognizably Jewish. And she's a really interesting case, especially because she was sent out. She was very talented as a musician and was sent out to do the vaudeville circuit and, you know, to whistling men in a swimsuit. Mm-hmm. And she just said, hell no. She discovered people didn't want to book her because she was Jewish. That was the other problem. So she just bailed out and said, I'm going to do talks for the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. I'm sort of peeling off from Miss America. I'm going to do my own thing,
good.
Which was really great, you know? And so she clearly had some initiative of her own and wasn't just following the script.
Oh gosh. And
there were a few women like that who were very unusual and not your typical Miss Americas.
Oh, I cannot wait to read this book. And of course, you know, not just these tie-ins about women's bodies and what they're doing with their bodies and what they represent, but even you just mentioned, you know, the women who were concentration camp survivors coming up to show their numbers. Like, this is another, you know, very negative but meaningful tie-in to the work that you've done learning about tattoos and writing about tattoos over the years. And it's just so interesting how these things that seem really disparate do converge, and that there's just so much to learn from them.
Yeah, so much has to do with the body. Mm-hmm. for women. I'm discovering there's just endless information to be mined about the way women have used their bodies or have been forced to use their bodies, and sort of the good and bad that produces.
Ugh, and all of the psychological baggage that comes from it. So Margot, I've kept you for an entire hour, and I feel terrible for asking you.
Oh, that went so fast.
Yeah, I know. And I'm going to ask you for a tiny bit more time, because I end every episode the same way. I ask my guests two really kind of broad, big picture questions, and I know that everybody would love to hear your responses to them. So, they're sort of two sides of the same coin. I want you to think about the future in whatever mm-hmm. context is relevant to you right now. You're on sabbatical. It may be a personal context. It may also be a really global, you know, historical, whatever the case may be. The first thing is, when you think about, you know, the future, what is the thing that is keeping you up the most at night that you're really preoccupied by? Maybe you have a little bit more pessimism about, just the thing that's, you know, not sitting well with you. But on the flip side of that, when you think about the future, what are you legitimately and, you know, authentically sort of hopeful and optimistic about? I know those are two tough things. They may relate, they may not, but what's been on your mind lately?
Yeah, well, certainly Trump has been on my mind, and that's the thing that keeps me up at night mm-hmm. and makes me sad. And certainly the latest Trump infraction is, you know, children at the border being separated from their parents. So that's upsetting. And I think a lot of people are feeling a sense of helplessness and despair that it's come to this mm-hmm. and, you know, what can we do about it? But for the professional answer would be a more simple one, which is, I want to know, and what I think about a lot is, what does Miss America mean and what has it meant?
Yeah.
Because I'm sort of deep in that research right now. And as far as where things are going, for women in particular, since that's a lot of what I think about, I do feel like we are going in a good direction, like with the Me Too movement and the greater awareness of around women's bodies, since I think so much about women's bodies, mm-hmm. I do think we're making progress and coming together. And with so many women entering public office, only good things, or mostly good things, Trump notwithstanding, can happen from here.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, all I can say to that is hear. Margot, thank you so much for joining me. It's been incredibly enlightening, and gosh, I just learned so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a gas to talk to you. I loved it.
Oh, yay. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.